This is The Takeaway. I'm Nancy Solomon, a reporter in the WNYC newsroom in for Tanzina Vega all week. And we're very excited today to welcome our new listeners at WAMU in Washington, D.C., who have joined The Takeaway family of listeners. Good to have you with us.
Now, because all the work we've done, we'll have enough vaccine supply for all adults in America by the end of May. That's months ahead of schedule.
We begin this hour with a look at global vaccine distribution. More than 61 million people in the U.S. have been fully vaccinated. That's nearly 19% of the total population, according to new data from the CDC. President Joe Biden said the U.S. is ahead of many countries in terms of their vaccination rate.
Because we're actually on track to reach this goal of 100 million shots in arms on my 60th day in office. No other country in the world has done this. None.
But the outlook is far less rosy globally. High-income countries like the U.S. have purchased over half of the world's supply of vaccines, even though they make up less than a fifth of the global population. Only 84 countries currently have COVID-19 vaccines, although the WHO estimates that that'll rise to 100 in the next couple of weeks. That's led to deep disparities in vaccine distribution worldwide, which not only poses an ethical conundrum, but also creates a public health challenge. That's because if the virus is left unchecked by vaccines, high levels of spread in any country provides fertile ground for the development of new and possibly vaccine-resistant variants, which could dismantle the global progress in the fight against COVID-19. For more on this, I'm joined by Yasmin Serhan, a staff writer at The Atlantic. Yasmin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Dr. Jen Cates, the Senior Vice President and Director of Global Health and HIV Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Dr. Cates, glad to have you with us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So what is the Kaiser Family Foundation seeing in terms of vaccine access in high and low income countries?
Yes, good question. We've been looking at this for quite a while and put out a report recently to highlight the fact that there is a very big disparity, as noted in the intro, that high-income countries, including the U.S., EU, have purchased most of the doses, and very few doses available are going to low and middle-income countries, and that presents a real barrier. Right now, only about 4% of the global population has been vaccinated. And that's very far away from where we need to go, and it's hard to see how we're going to get there.
And is the disparity found across the board in terms of, you know, from vaccine supply to vaccine access to rates of vaccinations? Are the disparities there in each category?
They really are. So it starts with who's been able to purchase doses, as well as who's been able to manufacture them and access them. But once, let's say there was enough vaccines to vaccinate everybody and it was already delivered to countries, there's a whole range of other challenges around infrastructure to deliver those vaccines. As we've seen in the United States, it's not as simple as sending vaccines to a state. There has to be a delivery system. And so that's another challenge that many low and middle income countries are going to face.
And what countries or regions are you seeing the supply especially inadequate right now?
I think the big challenges are primarily in Africa, where very little vaccine has been delivered now. And we know that some of those countries have done quite amazing efforts in terms of their response to other epidemics like HIV and actually even with COVID. But still, the infrastructure there in terms of healthcare workers and facilities to manage and store vaccines are really needing a lot of attention. So in addition to having very few vaccines delivered to many countries in Africa, there's going to be an uphill battle to getting that scaled up.
Yeah, I believe NPR reported that Africa has 17% of the world population, but only 2% of the vaccine supply. Yasmin, let's bring you into this conversation. How does this compare to the rates of vaccination or even the supply here in the United States and other Western countries?
the U.S. Is in a very good position, as I'm sure many of your listeners are probably aware. Duke University has a great vaccine procurement tracker, and they found that the U.S. has reserved, I think, around 1.2 billion doses so far, which is far more than it will need to inoculate its entire population. Meanwhile, Britain is doing quite well. Britain is where I'm based currently. It's vaccinated about half of its population. It's on track to vaccinate, I think, offer a first dose to every adult by summer. The Biden administration obviously has a similar goal. Israel, I believe, is leading the world in vaccinations per capita. So the wealthy countries are doing just fine. As you mentioned, they have the lion's share of the available vaccines, and most of them have reserved more doses than they'll need.
I have to say, you are harshing my buzz, the two of you, because I was feeling pretty good about getting my first shot. But this is obviously a moral issue, but it's also a public health issue. Yasmin, you wrote about that for The Atlantic. Tell us about what the public health implications are of these disparities.
Yeah, I mean, you touched on it a bit in the beginning, but I mean, first and foremost, I think the biggest concern that we have, and we're already seeing the repercussions of it, are these new variants that are emerging. And those tend to be emerging in places where the disease, I should say, has been left just running rampant. So there was a South Africa variant, there was the Brazilian variant, there was the variant from here in the UK. So the biggest concern, I think, among public health experts is that these variants will effectively be able to escape the vaccine, and that if we see a rise in variants, that could eventually make, you know, everyone vulnerable again. This idea that we'd have a scenario of a never-ending pandemic. So it really is in the world's interest to make sure that the globe is, that countries around the world are able to vaccinate at roughly the same pace, or at least to ensure that there aren't major outbreaks anywhere. Because, you know, as you rightly noted at the beginning, if there are major outbreaks anywhere in the world, we're all vulnerable.
And I heard you correctly that you're talking indefinitely. Like, we could be living with COVID indefinitely if we do not get the whole world vaccinated.
Yeah, and at this point, it's looking like, I think the estimates I've seen is that it won't be till 2023 at the earliest before we have enough vaccines to cover the global population, which means that we really need to be working together to ensure that the most vulnerable around the world are covered, that frontline workers around the world are covered. But at the moment, you know, I don't want to harsh your excitement too much. You know, I'm really excited to see my family and friends getting vaccinated too. And, you know, I'm very much looking forward to my first jab. But, you know, there are people around the world, highly vulnerable, who need that jab more than I do. And I think we kind of, you know, need to start having a global conversation of, like, you know, how are we going to prioritize this? What is in the best interest of anyone to ensure that this, you know, this pandemic is going to last a long while? We know that coming out of this crisis is going to take some time. How do we ensure that we come out of it faster than just, you know, letting it exist anywhere and potentially threatening us all and, you know, preventing the economy from opening back up again? I mean, you know, there are public health and economic concerns here.
You know, it's upsetting, but it's not that surprising that we're seeing the same kind of health inequities that have long existed between rich and poor countries. Jen, what's been the history of pandemic response and vaccine rollouts? Has it ever been done well?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the biggest analogy that I like to make, where we've learned so much, is what's happened with the history of the HIV epidemic. Mm-hmm. And the one distinction I want to say is we don't have any vaccines for HIV, but what we do have in the HIV context are tremendously effective antiretroviral medicines. And when those first became available in the mid-1990s, very quickly it was clear that the high-income countries, the U.S., Europe, Australia, Canada, all had access, and death rates plummeted. And most of the rest of the world did not, and particularly stark was in sub-Saharan Africa. There was virtually nobody was able to access antiretrovirals. And a movement began to change that. And by early 2000s, the United States, and actually under President George W. Bush, launched PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which has resulted in providing antiretroviral therapies to millions and millions of people around the world who otherwise would not have them. And that, to me, that's a very close precedent of something that did occur. It required a lot of effort and focus and attention, but it demonstrated that it can be done. And so a lot of people today are calling attention back to that, saying we did it then. And now I think it's even more pressing because, as Yasmin was saying, the implications of this virus are different than the implications of HIV. And we're all living with this virus and at a different kind of way. And so it's you know, in everybody's interest to find a solution.
And staying with that reference to HIV and AIDS, how did that work exactly? Is it merely an infusion of U.S. funds that creates the ability to get people treatment, or is it a different kind of mechanism?
Yeah, so there were several elements that went into that I think are applicable today. There was a strong community advocacy movement to sort of push governments, the U.S. and others, to do more or to do, you know, to start to provide antiretroviral therapy. And prior to the U.S. Creating PEPFAR, there was the creation of the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. And so international efforts began. And those included an infusion of funding, as you mentioned, which is incredibly important, but also attention to the infrastructure and the healthcare workforce needs, as well as the supply chains. And in fact, much of that work could be built on right now for delivery of COVID vaccines. And that is what people are looking at. But the precedent is there, and I think the sort of building blocks are there as well. And the other thing it's required is sort of bringing along other global partners over time to participate. So it's not just the U.S. alone, although the U.S. continues to be the main donor to this effort.
And Jen, what do you see in terms of what kind of role President Biden or the U.S. could be playing at this point?
I think we see a very different role being played right now by the Biden administration than the Trump administration, in part because of where we are in the rollout. But the Biden administration has said it will be active in the multilateral context. It has said it's going to help find solutions. And I think it's you know, the next few months will be pretty critical. And the Biden administration has to balance the needs at home with this global concern. And I think it's going to be really hard to talk to the American people about that and explain why both are important and both need to happen at the same time.
So let's talk about COVAX. Yasmin, do you want to give start us off with that and explain that program and what it is?
Sure. Yeah. So COVAX is a multilateral initiative that's backed by the World Health Organization, and it's basically aimed at solving the problem that we've been talking about of inequitable vaccine distribution. And its goal is to provide enough vaccines to cover at least 20% of participating countries' populations, effectively to provide vaccines to ensure that all the vulnerable people and all the frontline healthcare workers in countries around the world can get the vaccines they need. And this is an initiative that the U.S. has contributed to. This is new under the Biden administration. Under Trump, the U.S. did not join COVAX and numerous other countries around the world. And the U.S. has contributed billions of dollars to that effort.
And what about Russia and China? Are they filling a gap that's been left open by Europe and the United States?
They have indeed. Yeah, I recently wrote a piece looking at this. And whilst COVAX has been doing work to make sure that there is more equitable distribution, it hasn't been able to obviously distribute a lot. It's been affected by supply issues. And as we've already established, a lot of wealthier nations have really, you know, kind of taken a lot of the vaccines for themselves and their own domestic needs, which has left a gap that Russia and China have proven all too willing to fill. They have, I believe China has produced more than 225 million doses as of the end of last month, nearly half of which they've sent abroad. And Russia has also distributed, I believe, of the 14 million doses it has produced, 31% of which they've exported elsewhere. And they've been targeting countries around the world across Asia, Latin America, Africa. And the way a lot of Western leaders see it, they're effectively trying to really kind of bolster their own image, using their vaccines as sort of soft power, so to speak. They've been really kind of stepping in. And you see it even in wealthy countries like the UAE. The UAE is like Israel and the U.S. has vaccinated large swathes of its population, and it's largely done so, I believe, using Chinese vaccines.
And there must be just grave geopolitical implications, if not hazards, ahead given this restricted supply of vaccine. I mean, could this become the new oil? Could we be seeing, in worst case scenario, wars break out over vaccine distribution?
Gosh, I mean, I hope not. I think the way to understand this is that, obviously there are geopolitical concerns, and I think we've heard leaders talk about them. But, when it comes to a public health crisis, it really is in everyone's interests to ensure that vaccines are getting where they need to go. And in this respect, I've spoken to people who have really kind of criticized the politicization of these vaccines. Like, we're at a moment where, these vaccines are saving lives. And, if we aim to politicize them, it can cause a lot of problems. And I think crucial for a lot of U.S. and European leaders is that they may speak about, I think, leveled plenty of legitimate criticisms against Russia and China's vaccination distribution efforts, their aggressive sales tactics, their lack of transparency when it comes to efficacy data, their efforts to undermine trust in other vaccines. But, Western countries haven't really offered a lot of the receiving countries, many of which have scarcely begun their vaccination rollouts, any alternative. So as long as wealthy countries like the U.S., like Britain, are focusing on their own domestic needs, which, given how battered both countries have been by the pandemic, is understandable to an extent, they're really not in a position to tell other countries, look, you shouldn't take these vaccines because geopolitically it's bad for us. So I think it's really complicated, but I think, vaccines are unlike oil or any other sort of commodity that we would typically fight about. These are, products that save lives. And if they're safe and effective, we should hope that world leaders will work together to ensure that they get where they need to go.
So let's talk about pharmaceutical companies and manufacturers. Jen, what can you tell us about what their role has been and what they've done about vaccine inequity that we're seeing?
Yes, I think the big picture, as we've seen in many other cases, there's a few manufacturers right now that have come out with successful products, particularly that were for use in the U.S. and several other countries. China and Russia have also developed their products. But in general, there's a good story here and then maybe a more challenging one. The good story is that the pharmaceutical industry really did rally quite quickly and, in fact, worked together in some ways that don't usually happen to massively speed up, with help of government regulators and others, the process to get effective, safe vaccines into many countries and into the arms of millions of people now. And that is quite an amazing accomplishment, and one we should look back on and try to understand what was able to be done that we can learn from for future efforts, emergency or otherwise. On the other hand, there is a debate and a challenge going on about what should their role be in terms of easing up on patent protections and other regulatory mechanisms that allow pharmaceutical industries to enjoy protection for their products. Again, going back to HIV, this was a big battle in the HIV context, and there's going to be a tension, I think, between the pharmaceutical industry coming forward and sort of voluntarily making its technology available and making its products available on the one hand versus being, forced a little bit to do so. And that's a discussion that's happening at the WTO, and the US and some other countries are not supportive of easing up on those patents. So I think the issue of what happens with the pharmaceutical industry and how governments approach this is going to be one to look for in the next several months to over the next few years. And it could have some pretty significant implications.
Dr. Jen Cates is the Senior Vice President and Director of Global Health and HIV Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. And Yasmeen Serhan is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.